Ladies and gentlemen, good evening.
Welcome to Ben's Mark Synagogue. It's a pleasure to welcome all of you here tonight. Those of you who've been regularly coming to lectures, those of you who are here special tonight for this presentation about the West London Synagogue. I'm really excited. This is a lecture I've been looking forward to preparing and to teaching. And of course, it means a great deal to our community directly, not just because it's London, but of course because of the relationship of tonight's lecture to Bevis Marks itself. But before we jump into tonight's presentation, I want to spend a little bit of time just giving the background again, a bit of context for what we're talking about. Because what we've been looking at in the series, The Breakaways, has been this question about transformation. How these years of the 1820s to 1840s, essentially for Jews living in the West, creates in many ways the Jewish world that we know today. In some respects, and we've mentioned this many times, their community was very similar to our own. For the first time in the history of Anglo-Jewry, the majority of Jews living here were native-born. And that wouldn't necessarily be the case probably until this past generation again. You think of all the influxes of Jewish immigrants in the mid-1800s, and then at the turn of the century, and then World War II, and so on, that really until recent times, you don't again have the majority of the population being native-born. But that was the case in the early 1800s. And so you're dealing with a community that's in a very similar place, a place of people who are feel incredibly British, and yet they're Jewish people. And the struggle they face with those with that dynamic. And so it's a familiar struggle to us. And so many of the questions, many of the issues, many of the challenges that they face feel familiar to us, not even on a communal level, but on a personal level, and kind of the personal challenges we face with balancing our multiple identities. But what's significant, and this is one of the reasons that it's so difficult, because not only will these changes create kind of the landscape of the Jewish world today of, you know, reform and orthodox and, you know, that type of dynamic, but really the structure of the Jewish community is going to change at this time and create the structure that we know of it today. Before the 1800s, most communities operated on what was known as the Kehillah model, right, where essentially you had a synagogue community. The synagogue was the community. The synagogue had control over kashrut, and over the bet din, and over the education of the children, and the mikvaot, and the bakery, and the butcher, right? It all fell under the rule of the synagogue, right? And so you're going to have this shift where you have one or maybe two communities that essentially operate as self-containing Jewish worlds, right? To the shift to what's going to be the synagogue model, right, where you're going to have many synagogues, and therefore not any single synagogue is going to have all of these infrastructures associated with it, but rather those will be often operated by independent institutions or part of much larger conglomerate communities, right? And so in that way, it's very different. And this is all going to happen starting in these years that we're looking at, right, of the early to mid-1800s. Now, we've seen that this experience happens across the West. Right? We previously looked at what would happen in Hamburg, right, which is where it's attributed to be the first Reform synagogue, right, would be constructed. Right? We saw that in our first lecture. And then, of course, we looked at New York last week, where they had their breakaway. Their breakaway wasn't Reform. That Hamburg was a Reform Ashkenaz formation. New York was a Orthodox Ashkenaz breakaway, which would eventually lead to founding of B'nai Jeshurun, which today is a massive conservative synagogue in New York. And our last session, next month, we're going to be looking at Charleston, which is going to be a really interesting story because it's going to be an Orthodox Sephardic breakaway from the previous Spanish and Portuguese community there. So each of these cases are a bit different. What we're going to be looking at tonight, of course, is London. And we'll be seeing how what's going to happen here is going to be something new, and that it's going to be essentially a Sephardic reform breakaway, right? So Hamburg is Ashkenaz, so they take many of the forms of Sephardic practice in their formation of their community. New York is Ashkenazi Orthodox, Charleston will be Sephardic Orthodox, and London is Sephardic reform. as we'll see, the majority of people who found the synagogue are coming from the Bismarcks, though there are some Ashkenazim that are also part of the leadership of that new community as well. So we'll look at that as we go. So one of the things we're going to be looking at, and some scholars looked at, is going to be the question of, are these the same or are these different, right? These two kind of initial Reform congregations in Hamburg and London, are they the same event that's taking place, or are they actually in certain ways different? We'll be looking at kind of similarities and differences in order to understand really what's happening here in London. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at the backdrop, so to understand what's specifically happening in London, what's kind of the lead up to what will take place, because the breakaway will happen in 1840, and we'll look at the fallout and the reaction to the breakaway as well, particularly looking at the reaction within in this community, right, which felt so impacted by this particular change. Okay, great. Okay, so let's get started over here. As I mentioned, the synagogue will be founded, or the community breakaway will be in 1840. We'll take a look at a little bit about that as we go. We'll get to some of the kind of the nitty gritty, but I just want to do a little bit of the overview before we get there. They'll actually build their synagogue. So they'll actually have a proper synagogue starting in 1842. In the interim between 1840 and 1842, they will create their own prayer book. And so in 1841, they will publish their prayer book, which we'll talk about. This is led by several leading families, the Makadas, the Montefiores, and Ashkenazi goldsmith families. These families are connected through business, through marriage. They're connected in a lot of different ways. What they will call their synagogue is the West London Synagogue of British Jewry, right? So essentially trying to say, we're neither Ashkenaz nor Sephardic, we simply are British Jewry, kind of like a new kind of community, right? It's bridging the gaps. Essentially, they will be Sephardic in terms of the rite that they use, though there will be certain Ashkenazi elements that will be incorporated into their prayer book at that time. But these will be important families that have been leading families in their synagogue, right? In the great synagogue on Duke's Place and in Bevis Marks over here. And so it will cause rupture because there will be members of their families that don't leave, right? And that are quite upset about them leaving. We know there's going to be a huge feud within the Montefiore family between Sir Moses, who is staunchly, shall we say, now that there's a reform, you can call it Orthodox, right? Staunchly Orthodox. And he never speaks to his brother again after this feud, even on his brother's deathbed. When his brother asks for Sir Moses to come, Sir Moses says, I will come if you officially separate yourself from this reform movement. And he says no, and he says, so I'm not coming. And so it really rips families apart. So this is a really personal breakaway that takes place. And in that sense, it's a really major event. It's an event that sends shockwaves throughout London Jewry, because this is not just some kind of new people that come in and start a new synagogue. These are people from their communities who are doing it. And it caused great division in community and in families as well. One of the major issues that we'll have and we'll face this, right, is the question that they, in the establishment of this new synagogue, there'll be certain problems associated with it that we'll look at. One will be the fact that it's a reform synagogue, right? So they've changed. We'll look at the changes that they instituted, right? That kind of go against traditional Jewish practice that cause, right, lots of consternation among the traditionalists. But there's also kind of a technicality problem, which is the number one rule of the community, Askama number one, from when the community was founded in 1664, right, is that you cannot have a second synagogue within 6 miles of the community. And so they are transgressing kind of the number one principle of the community of not having a breakaway, not having a division within the community. And so that's going to be cause all kinds of challenges, and we'll look at exactly what the challenges are, but that's a major point of controversy within this, is that even besides for the fact that what they might be doing is reform, there's a problem that they are transgressing Askama number one, right? The number one rule. So that's something that we're gonna take a look at as well. But let's take a little bit look about what they do. So one of the things that we mentioned that they do is they will create a new prayer book. It's by a fellow whose name is Marx, nothing to do with Bevis Marx. His name is Marx. And they will make certain changes. I'm gonna tell you some of the changes they make, and tell me what you think the ideology is behind these changes, okay? Because this is one of kind of the interesting things, trying to understand, like, how are they determining what changes to make, what changes to not make. So one of the changes they make is that they do not have the blessing before the saying of Hallel. They don't say a blessing before lighting the Hanukkah candles, and they don't say a blessing before reading Megillat Esther, the book of Esther. They also do things like abbreviate the service. They want a later start time for the service as well. They find 8:30 a bit too early for people to get there. They institute a choir. They want a very orderly service. They make this part of their regular service. It will be an English language sermon. That will be part of the regular service. They say that there will be no, they'll of course observe Shabbat and the holidays according to all of the laws, but they won't keep the second day of the holidays, right? The Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galiot, right? The second day, which had traditionally always been kept outside of the land of Israel. And so those are the changes that they make. Changes that they don't make, that you find in Hamburg, for example, is there is no removal of the prayer for the Messiah and the return to Zion. That's still part of their prayer book. There's no removal of the prayers associated with korbanot, with sacrifices in the temple. Those are part of their prayer book as well, right? So the question is in looking at what they create is, you know, what is the ideology, right? Because they don't seem to make some of the changes that they did in Hamburg, Messiah, temple, sacrifices, and yet they do other things that they didn't do in Hamburg, like abolish the second day of holidays. Right, so there's a lot of difference. The question is, what is the ideology of this group when they create their prayer book? Does anything stand out to anybody about what maybe is going on over there? Yeah.
No Shabbat on the second day Sabbath.
Okay, what do you mean?
I see Hanukkah hadn't yet happened. If the canon hadn't yet been formalized, second day, because you're outside and definitely in exile rather than possibly returning.
Okay, you're getting on something, but it's not quite that. But anybody else have any thoughts about what's maybe going on over here?
Well, I think it's a distinction between what's in the Torah and rabbinic law.
Excellent, exactly. They're distinguishing between the Bible and the Talmud, right? And essentially saying everything which is in the Torah, of course we keep that. Of course we're going to follow the laws of the Torah. That comes from God. That's dictated word for word to Moses on Mount Sinai. We would never dream of transgressing anything that's written in the Torah. But what it says in the Talmud, it's written by a bunch of rabbis. It's stuff they instituted. We're not obligated to follow what some people decided to write, right? That we're not going to follow. And so they kind of go through and they say anything which is rabbinic, we're going to move away from. Anything which is biblical, that we're going to do. And so the blessing that we say before lighting the candles on Hanukkah is, blessed are you, Lord our God, who sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us to light the Hanukkah candles. Well, it's post-biblical, the story of Hanukkah. So where did God command us to light the Hanukkah candles? It's a question the Talmud itself raises, right, with how we say that blessing, right? But they pick up on that and they say anything that kind of seems to be not biblical, that's going to be excluded from kind of the religious practice, at least in terms of identifying it as something we have to do. Yeah.
So in terms of like the blessings before and after reading the Torah, how can they actually keep those if those blessings didn't come out of the Torah itself?
So it's not that they're opposed to necessarily doing things that maybe the rabbis did, but they feel that they're not obligated to do them. Right? So they actually, one of the things they do get rid of is all the blessings before and after the Torah, because they find that it takes too long. Right? One of the things they're going to try to do is to shorten the service. So they're going to figure out what are things we can do to shorten the service, right? So things that are not mandated, not required, they're going to feel more comfortable, but they recognize they're part of tradition. So they're going to kind of be making choices, right, with what exactly they're going to do, right? So scholars would call this bibliocentrism that they have over there. And it's going to be significant. We're going to come back to it later because it's going to, it's going to cause other kinds of challenges with that type of approach as well. And so what ends up happening is they are doing reform, right? They are making changes to the traditional service, but their changes are different than the changes that are being made in Hamburg, right? Does everybody remember what kind of was driving the community in Hamburg, right? That kind of German reform that we might call it? What's driving German reform?
Emancipation. Equality between men and women.
But broadly speaking, right, they want to be German, right? And you can't pray for the return to Zion if your number one priority is to say, we are going to be Germans of a Jewish persuasion. Because what kind of German are you if you're praying for a return to Zion? Right, and so they're going to be guided a lot by those kinds of issues, right? Questions about what about Judaism separates us from other people, and what about Judaism doesn't, right? And that's going to be a little bit of the thing that guides their reform movement. So we'll get a little bit into that as we go forward, but that's a little bit of kind of the difference that's going to be happening over there, and it's going to mean that the trajectory of German reform and British reform are going to go in different directions ultimately, because they're being guided by different kinds of principles, right? German reform is kind of looking at the entire canon of Judaism and saying what makes sense to us, what doesn't make sense. British reform is going ahead and just say if it's biblical, we do it. If it's rabbinic, we'll see, right? Well, you know, that's then up for discussion. Right, so that's going to be kind of the a major difference between German and British reform. Does anybody know where the first location of the West London Synagogue was? Anybody know?
Was it a hotel? Was it a hotel?
So it was a place called Burden Street. Burden Street, they called themselves the West London Synagogue of British Jewry, but in all of the records in Bevis Marks, they refer to it as the Burden Street Place of Worship. they refer to identified as a synagogue. So it's interesting, kind of like looking at the documents for the way that it's referred to. So that's essentially what it is, right? And it goes there and they establish it, right? It's the community, right? It still exists today. Are there people still at the synagogue who are from the founders? Anybody, do you guys know, are there families still, the descendants? Yeah? Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, you are?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Which family are you from?
Yeah, but I'm not a fan, but I go there.
But there are people from...
Oh, yeah.
Yes, okay, yeah. So the community succeeded, right, in essence, right? The community is still there. So what I want to look at, and this is what I'm kind of interested in, is kind of understanding what's happening. According to an article I found in Haaretz, this is a picture of the synagogue in the 1800s. I tried to find other references to it, I couldn't, but at least that's one of the things I found. It looks very, you know, similar to, you know, what you'd find in a place like Bevis Marks. You know, even the Rimonim right on top of the scroll, right, is very similar to the Torahs here, and obviously the way the ministers are dressed and the top hats and, you know, all those kinds of things. So it's familiar in that regard. What's interesting is there they didn't mix the pews. Men and women still sat separately, right? So in German they did mix it. So there's lots of differences between British reform and the German reform, at least during this time in the history of the movement. So let's take a look, and this is where I want to kind of get into, because the question is again going into a little bit more about this question of how it's different from German reform, and then we'll kind of get into a little bit more. Is one of the things that's that's different about it, and we kind of already alluded to between kind of biblical and rabbinic, is that they don't use what later German reformers will call kind of a historical approach to Judaism, right? Or a rational approach to Judaism, right? They don't see Judaism as an ever-evolving movement. What they see as reform is a return to what they see as the original or pristine form of Judaism, right? So as opposed to German reform, which is going to look at it and say, reform is about the evolution of Judaism over the ages, right? And so they don't necessarily see it that biblical is more significant than rabbinic, or that rabbinic is, they just see it that was Judaism, and things evolve. And so ultimately, all things will evolve. The rabbinic parts, the biblical part, right? Things will evolve over time. And so in the 1850s, we might think this is how it should be. In the late 1800s, it might evolve in a different way. 1900s might evolve in a different way. While the British reform, right, during this time is really making an idea of not evolving, but returning, right? Kind of going back to, in their sense, to the source, right? It's in that sense, it's very, what we might call Protestant, but very much kind of similar to what might be happening in the Church of England, right, at that time, right, with the Oxford movement, right, this kind of interest to return, right, they kind of readopt certain Catholic practices in the Church of England, right, they kind of, what becomes known as High Church, and so there's a kind of interest in saying, let's kind of get back to the way things had previously been in certain ways. So obviously, the way things have been depend on what your point of reference, right? Kind of, what are you going back to, right? People are always trying to go back and claim authenticity and go back to the original. What year are you talking about when you talk about those things? So as a result, and this is something that will be interesting, is what you find is that, and this is just the reality, right? British Reform does not have the sweeping success that it enjoys in Germany or ultimately in America, right? Where in America, like 90% of synagogues, you know, by the late 1800s will be Reform congregations, right? Germany will be predominantly Reform synagogues. In Britain, that will never be the case, right? The majority of the synagogues will remain Orthodox, right? The majority of new synagogues founded are what we would call Orthodox. And so that's a big difference kind of in the trajectory. So some people want to attribute it to this different approach to reform that British Reform has, right? Which some kind of historians of reform say that as a result of kind of this split between the Bible and the rabbinic, but not taking this historic development approach, it essentially, what you might say, ossifies, right? They make the initial changes and then they say, okay, so now this is it. There's no room then to make further changes because the point is you're trying to just be biblical. So what other changes are you going to make once you've just kind of moved away from the rabbinic things? And it means that in a certain ways, it's very much keeping with the times in the mid 1800s, but not necessarily keeping with the times when you get to the late 1800s. Though obviously there will be German reform influences ultimately in the West London synagogue and in British reform. There'll be the development of the liberal movement, which will kind of be taking more of that historic German approach to Judaism. So things will continue to shift, but it may partly explain some of the challenges. We'll see some of the other reasons that perhaps it doesn't have the same kind of success is, of course, because of centralized authority that you have within the British Jewish community, right, with the chief rabbinate. And it means that synagogues tend to be founded under the umbrella of the chief rabbinate. And so you don't necessarily have each synagogue operating independently with the ability to make the changes that they want to make if those changes are not authorized by the party that owns the synagogue, which is not the people who go to the synagogue, but which is the umbrella institution, which is, right, by the late 1800s, we'll call the United Synagogue, right, or the Spanish and Portuguese community. And so as a result, while in America, most early Reform synagogues were Orthodox synagogues, if the people chose to change their synagogue to Reform, that simply can't happen in London, right, because the synagogues are owned by the umbrella, and if the umbrella doesn't authorize it, all the people in the synagogue can want that, but they can't change the synagogue. They can leave and start a new synagogue, but they can't take their building with them, right? And so that, I think, limits a little bit kind of the ability for the movement to take off the way that it takes off in other countries. Some people attribute it to kind of the inherent British traditionalism, as playing a role. That might be part of it. And the other part, and this thing we're going to look at, is that some people think that perhaps the kind of the Orthodox synagogues, you know, Duke's Place Synagogue and Bevis Marks, ultimately do adopt certain changes that make their synagogues palatable to people who want certain reforms. They don't go as far as the reformers go, but they do introduce certain things, as we'll look at, and it could be by doing that they kind of ameliorate some of the people that would have wanted that otherwise would have gone over to reform and started reform. They kind of felt, okay, well, we can live with this, right? And they end up kind of staying put with where they are. So there's a variety of factors that probably go into play for why 90% of synagogues in England are not reform the way they were in Germany or in America. But that's no way to know for sure. But those are kind of some of the theories that kind of look at that.
Is traditionalism a euphemism for just can't be bothered to do it?
To what?
Is traditionalism a euphemism for they're just apathetic?
I don't know. I'll let you answer that. You have the right accent to answer that question. Yeah. Was that a question or a statement?
My big question.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. It's a good question. One of the things that we do find, and this might be part of it, is that one of the things you do find in the synagogues is there is an openness, and we're going to look at this now, to people of different religious observances, right? So they're not necessarily requiring everyone to be strictly Orthodox to be part of these Orthodox synagogues, and that might be also part of what allows it to work as well. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about backdrop, because the backdrop is, of course, and here we'll kind of start getting to some of the sources, is that there is dissatisfaction in the community, and it's not new. The dissatisfaction does not start in 1840. There are precursors to dissatisfaction. Let's take a look. There is a report which is issued in 1828. In 1828, the Chacham of Bevis Marks Synagogue dies, Raphael Meldola. At that moment, I guess that's like a moment where they say, well, let's get a committee together. They call themselves the Committee for the Promotion of Religious Worship. And the objective of this committee is to recommend changes or things that the synagogue can do to make the synagogue more attractive to people. Because one of the things they've been finding, really since the late 1700s, is that attendance is not what it should be. And you see references to poor attendance over and over and over again during these decades, right? So there is a real recognition that while there may not be reform, right? And it's not that necessarily everyone's just going and converting, people are just not going to synagogue, right? They're just not interested, right, in going to synagogue anymore. And there's a real sense of saying, well, maybe the reason people aren't going to synagogue, right, is because the service is not attractive enough. We need to be doing things in order to make people want to go to synagogue. And if we do that, then the people will finally go to synagogue. And so they make a number of recommendations. One of the recommendations they do is they say, well, the synagogue school, Sha'arei Tikva, one of the things that should be added to their curriculum is to teach the boys how to do the chanting, right? How to participate in the service, right? Not enough to just kind of educate them, teach them. You need to actually teach them how to lead the service. This will lead to, and it's already started a few years before, to saying, well, let's kind of have some kind of choir. Wouldn't that be nice to have a choir in the synagogue? That will make it that responses will be done together. There'll hopefully be one level of the voices. It won't just be different people kind of screaming out at different ways. But if the kids are taught how to participate in the service, then the kids will go to the service. And if they don't know how to participate, then they won't go. And so they say one of the schools that has to do is to start to do that. Good. One of the other recommendations they make is they say the parnassim, the wardens of the synagogue, need to attend more often, and they need to stay in their seat till the end of the service, and they need to refrain from talking so that they can be a positive influence. Now, some of the members of this committee were Parnassim themselves, right? So they're talking about themselves as well, saying, you know, it starts with the leadership, right? The leadership has to set the example. So if the Parnassim are not showing up, if they're not remaining quiet, if they're not remaining until the end, then of course that's not positive. You know, what everyone else say, well, if the leaders aren't doing it, why should we do it? So one of the things they say is the Parnassim. Don't worry, Stuart, I'm not looking at you. Okay. But it's only because you're a Parnas par excellence. Okay. Now.
It's just being reported.
It is. Good. Okay. Excellent. Now, one of the things they also say is that we need to teach the children Hebrew. And they say this is to the parents. Say, parents, it is of the utmost importance that you make sure your children know how to read, are comfortable in Hebrew. Because, of course, if a child is not comfortable in Hebrew, they're not going to be able to participate in the service in the synagogue. And if they can't participate in the service, of course they're not going to want to go, and they're not going to go as kids, and they're not going to want to go as adults. This is still a problem, right? You need to make sure the kids can read Hebrew and are comfortable with the service if you want them to then feel they can go to the synagogue. If they can read Hebrew and they know the service, they're going to enjoy coming because they'll be able to sing along and be able to participate and they'll be able to kind of take a role. And so they say that's something which is really important to do. Another recommendation they make is that announcements should be made in English. Until then, announcements were made in Portuguese. And so they said, nobody speaks Portuguese anymore, right? This is 1828. What are we doing speaking Portuguese anymore, right? And so they recommend that announcements should be made in English. Until this day, we make some of our announcements in Portuguese. So there you have it. Some of the things remain. But of course, most of the announcements are now made in English. So that's one of the changes that will be recommended at that time. Though now it's really cool to come to the synagogue and actually hear announcements in Portuguese, which is kind of neat. And the last one is they say we should introduce some English language sermons, right? So that we can have some instruction. They say there should be a weekly Shabbat afternoon lecture of 45 minutes and an occasional Shabbat morning sermon. What they say is anyone that would like to give one of these should apply to the board for permission to do so. They should submit the text of everything that they want to say, and the board will either approve or not approve of their lecture. And so there was high scrutiny on what the rabbis were teaching to make sure they would not say anything that would be against, you know, the customs of the land in which they lived, and of course would not contravene traditional Jewish practice. And so that was kind of one of the, they wanted to kind of really supervise very carefully what they did. The first English language sermon is delivered in 1831. In the synagogue. So there's a recognition that things are not working quite right in the community earlier on, and they're proposing changes, they're proposing shifts, they're introducing things, they want to make the service run more smoothly, they want the people to participate more, they introduce a choir, right? There's all these things that are being done. They want there to be English, they want people to be able to come to synagogue and to be able to learn something as well. So there's all of these changes that are already happening in the community during these years. And so they make a variety of different reforms at this time, right? Not reforms that contribute halakha, but reforms in terms of the way the service is going to function, right? And that's significant. And there are people who are traditionalists who are opposed to that. And we'll look at the traditionists as well. But the community does kind of proceed with certain kinds of changes. Now, that will go ahead. But that will not make some of the people happy. There will be people who will still be itching and saying, it's not enough, it's not enough. And this is what they're going to do. They're going to submit a petition in 1836. And their petition, they say the following. They say, we request such alterations and modifications as were in the line of changes introduced in the Reformed Synagogue in Hamburg and other places, right? And so they are very clear, right, that when they talk about reform, they are talking not just about that there should be English sermons and people should read Hebrew and there should be a choir. That's all well and good. But we are talking about serious reform, right? We need to amend our prayer book, right? We need to really change the way the service is running if we want it to be attractive, right? And they will make this very clear. The service is simply too long. We need to pull parts of it out or we're not going to want to come anymore, right? And so they say very clearly their model is Hamburg. Now, as we said, the ultimate reform will not exactly follow the Hamburg model. It will be reform in a British version of reform, but they clearly know about what's happening in Hamburg, right? And reform in Germany, and they're saying, come on, get with the times, right? We should be making these kind of more radical changes as well. Petition does not go down well. Needless to say. There will be three camps that will take form in 1838 as a result of kind of some of these agitations towards these changes. And I'll just read to you the names of the different camps that are formed. So one is a committee. They're all committees because, you know, I don't know, they like having committees. So the first one, the people who are dissatisfied with how things are going form a committee for promoting order and solemnity in the synagogue. That is the name of their committee. We need to make our service run more solemnly. There will be another committee that will be reformed that will be called the following. The Society for Supporting and Upholding the Jewish Religion as handed down by us to us by our reverend and by our revered ancestors, and for preventing innovations or alterations in any of its recognized forms and customs unless sanctioned by properly constituted religious authorities. Full stop. More briefly known as Shomrei Mishmeret HaKodesh, the preservers of these sacred institutions. And so they have a very long name that make it very clear what their intention are, right? So you have people who are taking, promoting, right, reforms, right? And you have another camp which is organizing themselves, which is saying we are going to take a very, very strict position and say there are not going to be any reforms that are going to take place. We are going to preserve the traditions as they have been. Right? And again, they're not talking about the English sermons. They're talking about, right, changing the prayer book and those types of changes. Now, what's interesting is looking at who the people are in these different camps. The camp of the more strident reformers, some of them are from the very ancient families of the community. As I mentioned, the Makadas, the Montefiores, right? People who are, right, part of kind of the long-standing part of the community, and others. The ardent traditionalists tend to be Jews from North Africa that have moved to London, right? So far, Jews from North Africa who are taking a very traditional approach to things. And what you essentially have in the middle are perhaps the kind of the governing body of the synagogue, which actually, as we see, does not accept reform within Bevis Marx, and they also force this new society to dissolve because they say it's only going to cause dissension within the community, right? So they kind of take this middle road, which is saying, listen, we're going to preserve the way things are, but let's not, you know, start creating societies all over the place, right? And so they are probably, they're kind of, they're English Jews, they're not looking to do reform, but they're not, you know, kind of, they don't need to create societies with really long titles.
Middle of the road, you might say.
Yeah, in a sense, in a sense. Obviously, middle of the road is always relative, right? Everyone likes to call themselves middle of the road. So this is it. So this is kind of the layout of the community. The community is kind of pulled all in all different places. Now, there will be, at this time, a proposal that there should be a West London branch of Bevis Marx Synagogue, where people will say, well, let's set up a synagogue in West London, because one of the things they're going to say is, we're all living in West London. We don't live in the hovels of the East End anymore. We live in beautiful West London, and it's too far to walk. Right? The only one that's walking is Sir Moses, right, who walks 5 miles from Park Lane, right? nobody else, you know, is up for that. And you know, it's kind of considered to be, well, that's a reasonable claim. And so it seems it's kind of submitted. It passes round one, but then it's turned down for round two. Probably one of the reasons it's turned down is because they know at that point the people who want that synagogue in West London want to ultimately introduce changes. And so they kind of say, well, no, we're not going to allow that. Well, at that point, once a proposal for even opening up a synagogue in West London, even according to the rules, technically according to the traditions of Bevis Marx Synagogue, once that's turned down, well, that's the point where they say, well, we're done, right? We're going to actually separate and found a new synagogue. Now, one of the things that historians point out, and we'll get to that, we'll look at what actually kind of they submit, is that there is a lack of rabbinic leadership at Bevis Marx at that time. As you mentioned, the Chacham Raphael Modola has died in 1828, and they don't replace him. What they have in place is a chazan, a well-educated chazan, we'll return to him, De Sola, who's here, D.A. De Sola. And you have the son of Raphael Modola, David Modola, who is the head of the Bet Din. But they don't appoint either of them to be the chacham, the head of the community. So there isn't that strong leadership. And as we'll see, we'll get to the Ashkenazi community. The Ashkenazi community has a very elderly rabbi as well, who doesn't speak English. okay? And so there's kind of perhaps a lack of kind of strong leadership at this time to kind of guide things as it moves forward. So let's take a look. Let's look at the next text up here. So the chair of this group of people, these 19 individuals that will eventually form this breakaway, his name is Daniel Makada. Yeah, there you can see, right? So he's, really kind of important figure, right? And by the time he gets to 1840, right, he's in the prime of his life. So he becomes the chair of the committee. And this is the declaration that they make in 1840. They write the following. They say, we the undersigned, right? And they all sign it, the 19 of them. Regarding public worship as highly conducive to the interests of religion, consider it a matter of deep regret that it is not more frequently attended by members of our religious persuasion. We are perfectly sure that this circumstance is not owing to any want of general conviction on the fundamental truths of our religion, but we ascribe it to the distance of the existing synagogues from the place of our residence, to the length and imperfections of the order of service, to the inconvenient hours at which it is appointed, and to the absence of religious instruction in our synagogue. To these evils, we think that a remedy may be applied by the establishment of a synagogue at the western part of the metropolis, where a revised service may be performed at hours more suited to our habits, and in a manner more calculated to inspire feelings of devotion. Where religious instruction may be afforded by competent persons, and where to effect these purposes, Jews generally may form a united congregation under the denomination of British Jews. And they submit that, right, as their kind of original kind of introduction to say that we are going to form a new synagogue. Now, the following year, when they are ready to kind of move forward with kind of their bigger plans, they will submit a much longer letter to Bevis Marx, essentially laying out all the changes they intend to make. And that's where they talk about the changes in the prayer book and not doing the second day of the holidays and starting the prayers at a later hour, right, and things of that sort, right? And this will not be warmly received, right, within Bevis Marx. And we're going to look at a little bit of the reaction to this. Now, obviously, things have, I'm sure, changed in West London over the years. So I'm sure what, I'm describing tonight isn't necessarily what happens today. But this at least was its kind of initial founding, what it looked like. Now, just to kind of understand a little bit the way the community functioned at that time at Bevis Marx is you had what were known as the Ma'amad, who were kind of the board of trustees of the community. But they weren't the ones who were really in charge, because you had another group of people who were kind of the former members of the Ma'amad and so on, were known as the elders, the board of elders. And they kind of operated almost the way you think of like the House of Commons and the House of Lords operate. But the House of Commons were kind of responsible for kind of the day-to-day functioning, but ultimate authority, right, at that time rested in the House of Lords, right? And they were the ones who, right, nothing could pass without the House of Lords permitting it, right? And so the board of elders essentially was the real power within the community, and the Ma'amad were kind of responsible again for the day-to-day functioning. And so you kind of have these multiple tiers of kind of structure that are in place, right? The Ma'amad members maybe would change, over the years, but the elders was a more established body that would work to ensure continuity and that things would be maintained. So let's take a look at the reaction. The reaction I chose over here is from the Ashkenazi chief rabbi, which is countersigned by the Sephardi Beth Din. Okay, there's lots of other texts. I only pulled out some representative ones. This one seems to be responding particularly to the prayer book. But this is this Solomon Herschel. He's the Ashkenazi chief rabbi at that time, right? Kind of cool. Okay, but he doesn't speak English. Okay, so this is what's written, though, in his name. He goes, information having reached me, from which it appears that certain persons calling themselves British Jews publicly and in their published book of prayers reject the oral law. I deem it my duty to declare that according to the laws and statutes held sacred by the whole house of Israel, any person or persons declaring that he or they reject and do not believe in the authority of the oral law cannot be permitted to have any communion with us Israelites in any religious rite or sacred act. I therefore earnestly entreat and exhort all God-fearing Jews, especially parents, to caution and instruct all persons belonging to our faith that they be careful to attend to this declaration and that they not be induced to depart from our holy laws. Signed by the chief rabbi. And again, this is signed also by the Sephardi Bet Din as well. Right, so very strongly written document, right, defending the oral tradition, right, defending the Talmud and the traditional prayer book and so on. What essentially is he saying in this text, right, in terms of what's the impact of what he's writing over here?
Excommunication,
right, cherem, right, that you, these people are outside the pale of the Jewish community and you should have no communion with them, right? That will not only be the position that will be taken by the Bet Din, right? That will be the position of the Board of Elders as well, right? Because the Board of Elders will say, forget the religious issues, right, that are at play, right? The real issue is the following, and here I'll read to you what the Board of Elders write in 1841. He says, this meeting at once declares that in the event of the gentlemen subscribe that letter, right, they're referring to that letter where they wrote all the changes that they were going to be making, or any other member of our congregation combining to erect a synagogue westward and to carry into effect therein the principles they advocate in the said letter, either by admitting as their ritual the book of prayers forwarded to this room, which has already been prescribed by authority, right, meaning because the chief rabbi has already said that that prayer book is no good, right, or introducing or allowing the introduction of changes in our established forms, customs, and usages, save and except under ecclesiastical authority, such acts will be considered as a violation of the askama of kahal, right, the laws of the congregation, and render such and every person of our congregation so acting virtually excluded from yachid, right, from being a member, and liable to all penalties of that askama. Right, so anyone that participates in this new synagogue is excommunicated from the community. Now, you may say, well, who cares? They're leaving. They don't care if they're excommunicated, but they care deeply because this impacts burial. Right? They're saying they can't be buried in the synagogue cemetery. They say they cannot participate on any of the charity boards of the community, right? At this point, we're still dealing with a kehillah model. The community has all of these institutions that provide for the poor, that run the schools, right, that run all the institutions, and they're saying all these people, well, they can't participate in those things anymore. And these were things that mattered to the people that left because they were part of the community. They just wanted to have a synagogue closer to home that was different, but they didn't want to all of a sudden not be part of the community anymore. Right, and what they say is that they can't sit on the board, and they even write that you can't accept any donations from them. And these were wealthy people, right? So it's significant, right, that they're saying we don't want your money either, right? They're taking this chayim, they're taking this excommunication really seriously at this time. So it gives you a sense of kind of how significant, right, this moment is, right, and really kind of in that sense ripping apart the community. I'll read to you the beginning of that askama itself, that original rule, because it's interesting. So this is askama number one. It says the following. It says, this is the introduction to it. It says, duly considering how important is our union to keep us from giving offense to the inhabitants of the city, against which we have been cautioned by His Majesty, King Charles II of glorious memory. Right? And so this is from the times of King Charles, right, that apparently they had the sense that King Charles had said to them, you guys can be here, but don't start like creating multiple communities and divisions and essentially conflict within your community, right? If you guys are gonna start having fights, you guys are out of here. You guys can be here if you live peacefully, right? And so they really took this to heart to say, we can't have multiple congregations. You have no right to break away, to secede and start a new community, right? This was what we were told by the king in the 1600s, right? And we still follow that principle very strongly, that without, you know, kind of the sanction of the community, you simply cannot start a second synagogue. Whether or not you are a member of the community, you don't have the right to do that, even if you're not a member of the community, right? Even if you're not a member, you're still governed by the community, right? And so that essentially was their position, right? So they're taking a very hard-line position. Now, as I mentioned, there's going to be kind of all kinds of impact and fallout from this. Some people who are going to kind of really back this position as mentioned, Sir Moses takes this very seriously. He's the head of the British Board of Deputies, and he will take the position that Reform synagogues cannot have representation on the British Board of Deputies, right? The way the board works is that each synagogue kind of has their representative. And what he says is that the Reform community will not have a representative on the board. That will not be what everyone on the board will think, but Sir Moses, he runs the Jewish community, right? He is the head of the British Board of Deputies. He is the most famous Jew in the world. He is fabulously wealthy, very powerful, influential person, right? Some people say that's the reason Reform never takes off, because Sir Moses, who's like kind of the British Jew par excellence, is Orthodox. So why do you need to be Reform? You don't need to be British. You don't need to be Reform to be British. Sir Moses is the most British of all Jews, right? And but he very much defends that position. And it's not until, I think, the 1870s that there will be Reform representation on the British Board of Deputies. So it will be decades until that happens. So there'll be some people who take that very strong position. But there will be other people in the community that are going to be trying to create peace and are going to try to create a resolution to this. There are people who in the community are simply uncomfortable that there should be excommunication anymore. They say this is no longer in keeping with the Enlightenment. We don't excommunicate people. That kind of approach to religion is no longer appropriate. And so there will be a push for people to amend Askama number one, to say that even if you are in breach of it, you've still broken the rule, but you are not excommunicated. And they will succeed in doing that. They will succeed in changing the rule of excommunication. So it will then be brought to, and the question will be brought to the Beth Din to ask them, as a Persian, can they change the Askama? And they essentially say that if that's what the majority of the community wants, then the community can change it. Now, one of the things that's also clarified is that, well, so then the question becomes to say, well, that's fine. So now it's been changed. But the problem is the people who left in 1840, when they left, excommunication was the rule. And so even though now the excommunication law has been changed in 1840, whatever, does that retroactively undo the earlier excommunication or no? At that point, excommunication was in effect, and therefore, if you left under that circumstance, you're still excommunicated. And the Beit Din ruled that yes, since when they left, that was the rule. It doesn't make a difference if the rule has changed later, it has already been imposed on them, and you can't simply undo excommunication without undoing the reason that the excommunication was put on, which is leaving the community. Now, one of the things that's clarified is that the excommunication doesn't apply to the fact that they've done reform changes. The excommunication applies to the fact that they broke away, right? And so, which is ironic, because obviously in Jewish tradition, the more significant thing is the fact that they changed Jewish practice. But in terms of the excommunication, it applies to the breakaway. So what they end up essentially negotiating with the Beit Din, with Meldola, and he's writing to rabbis in North Africa and others to try to kind of find a halachic, opening for this, is what they essentially say is the following. Now, traditionally what would have to happen for someone to undo excommunication, they would have to come back to the synagogue, they'd have to say, I was wrong, I'm returned to the synagogue, and I'm paying a fine. And if you do that, your excommunication will be lifted. But these people aren't interested in coming back to the synagogue. They're certainly not interested in, undoing what's been, changing their reform practices. So what they end up negotiating is the following, is that they don't need to come in person to apologize. All they need to do is to admit that when they left, they were contravening the original law. And if they are willing to admit that they broke the first Askama as it was in 1840, then they can be released from the excommunication. And so it's not until like 1849 that all of this kind of negotiation is wrapped up, where I think out of the original like 19, it's like 17 of them are willing to put their name or something like that. A bunch of them are willing to put their name to this, and it's brought before the Beit Din, and the Beit Din says, okay, you've admitted what you did was wrong, therefore your excommunication is lifted. Even though nothing has changed, they started a new synagogue, they're not coming back, they're doing reform, but the excommunication has been lifted, and so now it's permitted for them to participate again. They're not permitted to necessarily participate in the school board, that's been excluded from them, but in terms of the charity board and the hospital and things like that, that they are permitted once again to be part of of the community in that way, even though they're not members of the community because they've left and formed a new synagogue. And so in that sense, the controversy, in a sense, dies at the end of the 1840s, in the sense where that just becomes the reality, that there's this new community, they've kind of resolved the impact of excommunication, and things will kind of go on. As you mentioned, things don't, you know, resolve, you know, completely. Travis Marx still sees the reform as being wrong, Sir Moses still won't allow them to participate in communal affairs, but they are able to kind of now socialize with other Jews, right? They are permitted to donate their money to Jewish causes, right? And so some of the divisions have been softened, have been resolved. And as it seems that over the years, relationships will continue and that there will be friendly relationships between, you know, this new synagogue and members of the old community where they, again, a lot of them were relatives, you know, a lot of them kind of carry on, and there is a relationship between these communities where, and again, in a certain sense, this synagogue, certainly compared to the later Reform synagogues or the liberal synagogues that will be formed, is much more traditional, right? So, you know, at least relatively speaking, compared to the German liberals that will come in the later 1800s, well, West London is, you know, kind of similar. They use essentially a Sephardic prayer book. They use lots of the same melodies. In fact, there'll be one time someone who's on the choir there will become the choir master at Bevis Marks later on. So, you know, there will be kind of a recognition that it's different, you know, that these are, you know, two different approaches, but that there still is certain bonds between the communities. Let's just talk about kind of some of the final fallout of this. This fallout essentially is the birth of Anglo-Orthodoxy, right? There's no such thing as Orthodox until you have Reform. So this is the beginning of Orthodoxy, but it's Anglo-Orthodoxy as it kind of is known at that time, which is kind of, it's Orthodox, but it's inclusive of people that are not personally Orthodox, right? It's kind of what we think of today when we kind of think about the mainstream Orthodox community in England, that it's kind of maintains the traditional practices, but within the community you'll have a mix of people who are, you know, very careful in their kind of practices, and people who are less observant, right? But they're still part of the Orthodox community, right? So you have many people in this country who, you know, are not personally Orthodox, but they identify themselves as Orthodox because they go to an Orthodox synagogue, right? So this is kind of Anglo-Orthodoxy. As I've already mentioned, the British Board of Deputies with Montefiore. One of the things that was really interesting to me is the impact on publications, because you see starting in 1840, whole bunch of publications being put out, essentially responding to the challenges of that time. So one of the first publications that you start finding at that time are newspapers, right? It's in 1841 that you're going to have the beginning of the Jewish Chronicle. You'll have another paper called The Voice of Jacob that will be around for 10 years, right? That started at this time, definitely kind of as a result of all the commotion. You'll have textbooks that will be written. Over here is one of the early textbooks. This one is published in, let's see what it is, it's 1848. This is by Miriam Mendes Belisario, right? This is the original copy from 1848. This is a Hebrew dictionary, essentially taking the prayers and translating the prayers word by word, right? So a interlinear translation, in a sense, of the Hebrew prayers, right? And this is meant for the children, right? So she's responding to that call that they had made to say, we need to provide Hebrew education for children, right? That's what it says in the cover. It says, intended for the use of schools and young beginners, right? So this is a book that's been created to make sure, let's teach the kids to know Hebrew, what the prayers mean. And so this is a response. So there's a whole bunch of educational material that will be published in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s in the Sephardic community. You have religious texts that will be written. Those are some of the texts we looked at in our previous lecture, also by Miriam Mendes Belisario, her Friday Evenings at Home, right? Her Sabbath Evenings at Home book, which is all about kind of what is Judaism, what are our beliefs, and what is Jewish practice, right? So she'll write, you know, books will be written, interesting, by women, many of them, for educating people, saying, well, we can't just expect people to just be in the community anymore. If we want them to be in the community, we need to educate them, right? Not that they're necessarily going to go to other communities, but they're just not coming to synagogue, right? We need to inculcate a love and a connection to Judaism if we want people to participate. We saw polemics that were written by people at this time. There's a whole swath, a wide variety of publications that are done. One of the important ones, religious texts, is written by the Chazan at Bevis Marks, David Aaron de Sola. He publishes an English translation of the Mishnah. I have it over here. This is a second edition English translation of the Mishnah that he writes. And I'll just read to you what it says in the introduction because it's telling, again, what's going on, probably as a result of that meeting in 1836. But he writes the following. He says, "The circumstances which give rise to the translation of the following portions of the Mishnah deserve a brief record in the annals of Jewish history." Right? He sees it's like, this is, you know, we're translating the Mishnah into English, right? It's never been done before. We know it's been translated into German in Germany, but it's never been translated into English. So he goes, "During one of the public discussions that took place at the vestry board of the Sephardim synagogue," right? It's the room that used to be upstairs over here, right? "On the subject of revising the liturgy used in that synagogue," right? So people who were advocating, let's change the liturgy and for improving its public worship, "the opponents to alteration took shelter under the authority of the Mishnah," right? So the traditionalist said, no, but it says this in the Mishnah and it says that in the Mishnah. "And this led the advocates of improvements to express their long entertained doubts as to the divinity of the oral law," right? So the people who were opposed said, we don't believe in the authority of the oral tradition. "These gentlemen, on being taunted with using arguments derived from partial extracts furnished by Christian writers, urged the necessity of being supplied with an English translation from persons of their own faith," right? And so there began arguing because people were quoting from the Mishnah in English from Christian sources. And so people were saying, we can't rely on that. That's a Christian translation. So people said, well, let's get a Jewish translation of the Mishnah. In consequence of this application, the meeting passed a resolution authorizing Reverend D.A. de Sola to translate the Mishnah, right? And that's what we then have here. This is from the 1800s, the first English translation of the Mishnah, right? The core text of the oral law, right? So this spurs a whole kind of movement, a whole kind of intellectual reaction within the community, sometimes being polemic, directly responding to reform, but some of it just saying, we need to better educate people. We can't expect people to participate, forget reform, we can't expect them to participate in synagogue life if they're not educated in Judaism. And as I mentioned, this is going to be the birth of British reform, which is going to be different than other reforms. And then ultimately, because of British reform being the way it is, it will also bring about the birth of liberal Judaism in this country as well, right? To the extent that, in some regards, British reform is akin to what we might call American conservative Judaism, and liberal Judaism in this country is more akin to what we would call reform in America, right? In terms of kind of the types of changes that are made, though you can't do an exact comparison anyway. But British reform is definitely somewhat different. To me, what's interesting, kind of the fallout, right, is it kind of establishes the place of the Spanish and Portuguese, right? Where the Spanish and Portuguese are what we might call an inclusive or a moderate orthodoxy, right? They do adopt certain types of change. They're open to saying, yes, we need to, we can make the melodies different. We can make our choir. We can make sure we have English sermons, right? We can do things to make it more palatable to, the English ear. But when it comes to the actual traditions, those we aren't going to change, right? So there's kind of what we might call this kind of moderate or modern orthodoxy, right? Which is what the Spanish and Portuguese community represent. And then ultimately, they will move west as well, right? And so very shortly after this, they will actually say, well, no, we're going to move west. And the reformers say, well, too late, And so even though shortly thereafter, there will be a synagogue that will be established in West London, it's not going to change the trajectory. It'll just mean that the Spanish and Portuguese will start expanding westward. I'll just say this as a pitch. We're actually going to be doing a walk on Sunday, July 8th, where we're going to be actually walking from Lauderdale Road Synagogue to Bevis Marks Synagogue. Right? So Lauderdale Road is the Spanish Portuguese Synagogue in Maydavale. We're going to be doing a 5-mile walk. It's called our Back to Bevis Walkathon. It's a fundraiser for kind of a resurgence happening at the synagogue today at Bevis Marks. And we're going to be stopping at points along the way that were points of significance when the community originally moved west. So we'll actually stop where Burden Place Synagogue was And we'll kind of stop at significant places. So we're kind of retracing the steps backwards as part of a symbolic return to Bevis and the kind of the resurgence of Jewish life in and around the city of London. So if anyone's interested, we'd love for you to sign up and participate in the walk. It's a fundraiser. If you want to sponsor someone who's participating, that would be great. But those funds will go towards kind of additional programming and activities here at Bevis during this kind of time of resurgence within the community. But what I will say is that this moment, 1840, was a major moment in the history of the community. In some ways, perhaps if Bevis had been a bit more proactive and a bit more forward-thinking, the split wouldn't have happened. In other regards, it probably would have happened anyway because of people that wanted not just a synagogue in the West End, they really wanted a different type of synagogue. But it did cause great controversy in the community. It was a wake-up call, I think, to the Spanish and Portuguese community to say that actually there is a great amount of kind of drift happening, and if you want your community to remain strong, you need to focus more on education and on learning resources within the community. And so in a certain sense, perhaps it actually saved the community because it meant the community needed to really redouble its efforts, which perhaps allowed it to not simply disintegrate through apathy, but actually to kind of start taking the community more seriously. So in some ways, sometimes controversy leads to strength as well. In any case, it was a major moment in the history of the community, which we still see the effects of it today, and led the way for, in a lot of ways, the Jewish world that we now know. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah.
I'm interested in what you said about the comparing the growth of the reform movement in America compared with the not such growth in this country. And I think you said that by the end of the end of the 1800s, the majority of communities in America were actually reformed.
Yeah.
But I would have thought that with the big influx of immigration from Eastern Europe, which happened in the 1880s, 1890s, the majority of people who came over would have been traditionally Orthodox.
They would, and so that's when you're starting to have Orthodox synagogues in America. Now, not every synagogue, like I said, it was only about 90% of them had gone, there were still Spanish Portuguese in New York was Orthodox, Spanish Portuguese in Philadelphia was still Orthodox, right? There still were Orthodox synagogues, but a lot of them had gone Reform. But you're right, when you start having lots of Eastern European Jews moving in, that will be kind of a re-emergence of Orthodoxy in America. But many of those people will eventually become Reformed themselves as well. But that will be a shifting point. That's true.
Because I would have thought that maybe was the main contributor to the stemming of the Reform movement in this country was the influx of the traditionally Orthodox that came.
Yeah, you would think so. But again, there's no stemming. It just it's not like all of a sudden by the time you get to 1870, before that happens, that all the synagogues here have gone Reform. It just hadn't happened. So it just never kind of went in that direction here, again, for all the variety of reasons. And then, of course, when you have the Eastern European Jews, they come in, and again, but some of them are not happy with the mainstream Orthodox, and they'll create other synagogue associations, right? Federation will be created and things like that, right? So there will be people who will come in and who will say, well, we don't like the kind of Anglo-Orthodoxy where you have mixes of people, some people who are Shomer Shabbat, some people who aren't. We want a synagogue where everyone is Shomer Shabbat, right? And so you'll have kind of, within the Orthodox community, different kind of camps that will be kind of come to the fore at that time. Yeah, Stuart.
At one point, at the time of that 1840 up to 1870, there were Ashkenazi synagogues in the West End, but they were very small.
Yeah, right, they had started some, yes.
But they, yeah. They had 20, 30 people.
Right.
More
yeah. Again, because it was the wealthier people that were moving out there, right? And so there were more wealthy, probably Sephardi Jews than there were Ashkenazi Jews at that time. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I agree with you that 1840 was a seminal moment in Anglo-Jewish history because of what happened later. I'm not so convinced that what happened in 1840 was itself as significant as you suggest. You've attached the title Reform to that breakaway in its early days.
They did.
Well, I think they're using the word in a different way, though. There are three principal drivers for the breakaway. And you mentioned them. And they're all pragmatic. There's nothing intellectual.
Correct. Yeah.
There's nothing doctrinal. There's nothing theological.
Well, the one doctrine is biblical.
Well,
yes.
You've emphasized that. I haven't seen, you haven't produced the evidence for it. And it's certainly not part of the WLS oral tradition as to how we react. It was the long walk, which was no longer acceptable.
Yeah.
It was the lengthy services, and it was non-English sermons.
Yeah.
And all those things are stated in the petition.
Yeah.
And nothing else is stated in the petition, unless it goes on for.
That's the petition. If you want, when we're done, you can read the letter that they submit.
I don't purport to be an expert.
No, I'll show you. You can read the letter.
I just relay our oral tradition.
The oral law.
The West London Synagogue of British Jews, I think it's Jews, not Jews, regarded themselves, as I understand it, as Orthodox. Yes, they were modernizing. These were very successful, as you said, affluent Victorian gentlemen, and it was an age of reform all round. They saw themselves as modernizers.
Yeah.
And all their attempts, as you've demonstrated so clearly this evening, all their attempts to get any movement and flexibility of modernization here were rebuffed, so they set up their rival organization.
Many things were instituted here, just not as many as they had wanted.
Agreed.
Yeah.
But West London Synagogue didn't really become reform in any recognizable state of that.
It's very different than German reform.
For
absolutely.
Quite a long time.
Yeah.
And it was then influenced by the German movement, of course, very much so. And
a lot of it happens after Marx dies.
Yes.
That's my sense. Yeah.
So when
does even in the early.
When is that? When it's 1890s?
But even in the early 20th century, chief rabbis were coming to West London Synagogue and preaching, and it wasn't regarded as beyond the pale.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I've seen references that when they build the synagogue in like the 1880s or something, we actually have representatives of Bevis and the Ashkenazi community that actually go to the dedication. So it's really interesting, right, to kind of see that there was this kind of peace that's made and kind of this. Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting, and it's why the liberal movement starts here, because they're not happy with it. They say this is not reform as we know it. So it's really interesting to kind of see how that plays out. So it's historians spend a lot of time trying to understand the differences. There's a major historian of reform, Michael Meyer, who kind of writes he has like the seminal book on reform, and he has an article actually which is specifically about German-British reform, and where he kind of goes into a lot of these issues. If you're interested, I can get you the article.
I don't know very much about this, but at some point we spawned the second large reform synagogue in London, which was in Hayworth Gardens. At some point, the reform synagogue movement was created, which must have given a great impetus.
Yeah.
I don't know when that was.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you.
I'm not sure that's a bit later.
It certainly wasn't. I'm thinking about the around about 1920. It certainly hadn't existed at that point even, because I have a ketubah of my grandmother, and it's still called the Manchester Congregation of British Jews, and there's no mention of reform at all. So.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's really interesting. They're kind of doing their own thing. Totally. Yeah, sir.
One point.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, the elders held sway for many years, and I first joined the elders 30 years ago, and at any meeting was only one decision, and that was how far does the discussion go before they say no. They've now been abolished, but I'm not sure the board does it. Don't quote me on that.
No comment. thank you all so much for coming. It was great having you. Have a lovely evening.